Hey, Voice Assistant. Programar cuarto nuevo.
Especificar el cuarto de la casa.
Atico.
Solo puedo agregar cuartos con internet.
Por eso, ahora que tenemos AT&T OFA y somos gigillonarios, hay cobertura de esquina a esquina, hasta el ático.
Recalculando.
Ahora con AT&T AllFi, agrega Wi-Fi de esquina a esquina. Obtén AT&T Fiber con AllFi y vive como gigillonario. Disponibilidad limitada. La cobertura requiere extensores por un cargo adicional.
Hey, Drew Scott here, and I'm Jonathan Scott, reminding you that life's better with a home policy from American Family Insurance. They can help you get just the right protection at just the right price and help you save when you bundle home and auto. Kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It'll be just right for you. We love a custom build. American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
All right. Hey, all right. What's happening, everybody? It's Vincent, and I am here with Joe, and we are at...
Hello, the CooperCon in downtown Vancouver, Washington.
Yeah, we're at the Kiggins Theater, hearing a lot of different presentations about D.B. Cooper and yes. Getting into the minutia of this.
Yeah, really the minutia. I mean, we're talking about, like, electron microscopy, for Christ's sakes.
It was a dark and stormy night. The date was November 24th, 1971. A man dressed in a business suit entered the terminal at Portland International Airport and bought a one-way ticket to Seattle on Northwest Orient Airlines Flight 305. The fare, with tax, was $20. He paid in cash. He had no luggage to check, but he was carrying a briefcase. The name he gave to the ticketing agent was Dan Cooper.
Featuring Joe Sweeney from Thinking Sideways Podcast and filmmaker Vincent Caldoni. This is The Shocking Details.
Hey there. Welcome to another episode of The Shocking Details. I'm Joe, joined by
Vincent Caldoni,
as always. Well, first off, I'd like to issue just a little mea culpa. I did take some liberties with the truth there because it wasn't a dark and stormy night. Not yet, but sundown was only a couple hours away, and there was a major storm system moving into the area from the north, so it was going to be dark and stormy pretty quick. And also, we usually try to get the more obscure stories that no one's heard of, but we're going to make an exception this week, because tomorrow, if you're listening to this on the day that we put it up, which is the 23rd, tomorrow, the 24th of November, 2021, it will be the 50th anniversary of D.B. Cooper's hijacking of Flight 305. So this is a special occasion, don't you think, Vince?
I think so. 50 years, man.
It's a very special occasion. So this is the beginning, tomorrow, the 50th anniversary of the beginning of one of the world's greatest unsolved mysteries. So we're going to talk about it a little bit here and, of course, go into endless theorizing about it. So let's get into the nuts and bolts.
So as Joe mentioned in the intro, Dan Cooper was also carrying a briefcase. He also had a paper bag that was approximately 4 by 12 inches by 14.
What was in the bag, I wonder?
There are really a lot of guesses.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was thinking, you know, we were at CooperCon this past weekend, and people were speculating on that on stage. And I've always thought, he probably had a pair of boots or at least some high-top shoes or something. And all those guys are going, oh, no, maybe gloves and, you know, goggles. And I'm thinking boots. But anyway, back to our story.
D.B. Cooper took an aisle seat at the back of the plane. Flight 305 took off on time, 2:50 p.m. Right after takeoff, Cooper handed an envelope to the nearest stewardess, Florence Schaffner. The envelope contained a note, something about a bomb. It also instructed her to sit next to him.
So he took his note back from her and scooted over so she could sit in the aisle seat. He opened his briefcase to give her a peek at his bomb, which she later described as 8 red cylinders with a large cylindrical battery. Then he told her to write down his demands and take him forward to the cockpit. So, first demand, $200,000 in cash. Denominations, unimportant. Innegotiable American currency.
2 parachute sets, e.g., 2 main chutes and 2 reserves.
And also a fuel truck standing by in Seattle when they landed.
Florence took his demands up to the cockpit, and of course the flight crew contacted the home office. They told him to meet Cooper's demands and they set about procuring the cash and the parachutes. A local Seattle bank had the money, 100 bundles of 20s, which they had already been photocopied to record their serial numbers. So they knew the serial numbers of the money, even if they were not necessarily sequential. Is that correct?
That is correct. They weren't sequential, but they had this stash set aside for just this contingency.
Wow, so, that's lucky.
Yeah. That's preparation. Yeah.
A local jump school in Seattle provided the parachutes. They screwed up slightly. The two main chutes didn't have D-ring attachment points for the reserve chutes, and one of the two reserve chutes was a training aid and clearly marked, so it didn't work.
And obviously, it said right on the front of it, yeah, not for real use. There was some speculation at the time why he asked for two sets, and a psychiatrist who worked for Northwest apparently said that he believed that he was going to take one of the stewardesses with him when he jumped out of the plane. So that kind of like that nixed the whole possibility of maybe sabotaging the parachute, you know, which I'm sure occurred to a few people. And that's probably why Cooper demanded two sets of parachutes for that very reason.
So I have an alternate speculation. Let's just hit that one real quick and then we'll move on. These were the kind of parachutes, correct, that were kind of like what they used in World War II. You couldn't really control them. They just fell straight down.
Yeah, back in 71, they didn't have the wide variety of parachutes and stuff that they have today. And so, they were not controllable, really.
They would have brought DB the money in once.
That's true. He did say denominations unimportant.
He said it didn't matter. Or if they brought him it in even just in fives or in some random mix of bills, and he felt it was too heavy, he would have to send the money down on its own, which would be maybe not even all that big a deal because he could just straight drop it. And he'd be able to figure out that if him and the money went out the door around the same time, it can't be far.
Yeah, that's a possibility too. But whichever way, it worked out well for him because they didn't sabotage his parachute. So yeah, that's nice. True. Yeah. But unfortunately, again, as we said, these were basically emergency parachutes. They weren't regular skydiver type parachutes. So there was no provision on them for attaching the reserve chutes to the front. There were no D-rings there for clipping in.
Right.
Yeah. So oopsie. Yeah.
Oops. So the jet flew around Puget Sound for a few hours while the cash and parachutes were rounded up. The pilot got onto the intercom and told passengers that they couldn't land just yet because of a minor mechanical difficulty.
Yeah, so I guess the thinking was that if they flew around for a couple hours, the mechanical problem would just iron itself out.
I actually think, I'm not trying to say anything negative about the pilots, but if someone is like, we had a little mechanical problem, we can't land just yet, we're going to fly in circles for a while, that would make me panic more than like if they said like, there's just a lot of backup at SeaTac. We just got
That's probably would have been a better one. Yeah, I think
I really think so. And again, I'm not trying to criticize the pilot. He was thinking on his feet.
Oh no,
but like
the mechanical
problems don't solve themselves while you fly.
Yeah, no, I think actually what he said was something like we have a lot of excess fuel on board. We want to burn that up before we try to land, which is also not reassuring. You know, when you think about it. I mean,
no. Why do we need to do that?
Yeah. I mean, I would have just said like maybe a family of polar bears had wandered onto the runway and they're trying to shoo them away and all flights are delayed.
Oh, those Seattle polar bears.
Exactly.
Just to be clear, Seattle is in the Pacific Northwest, but there are no polar bears in Seattle.
No.
Just in case we've got some overseas.
No, listeners. Just kidding there. But a family of, we don't even get moose this far south, unfortunately. But
not really. We used to. Anyway, at some point, another stewardess, her name's Tina Mucklow, took over the job as liaison to Cooper. She spent more time with him than anyone else. And later she would say that he was polite and calm, kind of a gentleman is how she described him.
Yeah.
She said he seemed, this is a quote here, rather nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a classy, a gentleman bandit.
But as they call him the gentleman skyjacker back in the day.
Yeah. And as they chatted, Cooper smoked Raleigh cigarettes and even offered her one, holding out the pack to her. She did take one, at least one. And Cooper left behind 8 cigarette butts, which were recovered by the Reno field office of the FBI later. And they were handed over to the Vegas office, which later lost them. There's a whole story right there, which is sad.
Now, that whole chain of custody thing is crazy.
It really is. And so God knows what happened to those cigarette butts. But damn, I mean, there'd be some useful DNA on there, I bet.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think there's a good chance that if they still had those cigarette butts and they'd been stored properly, and that's a big if right there, because they wouldn't, you know, obviously in 1971, they didn't know how to store something properly for a technology that hadn't been invented yet.
Oh, of course, yeah.
But if by chance they'd stored them properly, that would be the best way to identify D.B. Cooper through DNA and genetic forensic genealogy.
Yeah. Well, oopsie.
At one point, Tina asked him if he had a grudge against Northwest Airlines. And Cooper's answer was, I think, really kind of interesting. He said,
yeah,
I don't have a grudge against your airline, miss. I just have a grudge.
Yes, the famous grudge, the source of endless speculation by Cooperologists. And a lot of silly grudges have been proposed, but we're going to not talk about that in detail now. We will talk about it a little bit later.
Exactly.
But the grudge is like a key hinge point in this story for a lot of people, I think.
That's interesting. Yeah. Of course, he also could have just been saying something to say something.
I don't know. It could have been a diversion. It could have been just, a red herring. But I've got a few favorite theories of my own about the grudge. And right. I don't think mine are as silly as some others, but others probably think they're silly as hell. I don't know.
So at one point, Cooper was asked if military parachutes with altimeter releases would be acceptable. And I think this is fascinating right here. Cooper nixed these and demanded civilian parachutes with manual ripcords. I don't know enough about parachuting, but you think that implies that he would be planning to free fall?
Maybe. I'm not sure. Maybe he just trusted a parachute with a ripcord versus something that's got this automated little dealie on it. That was it. I don't know.
Maybe he thought that would be harder to sabotage.
Yeah, harder to sabotage or less likely to fail.
Sneak in a tracking device. I don't know.
Yeah.
So 5:39, the plane lands in Seattle. Cooper orders the pilot to park the plane away from the terminal in a well-lit area. Smart. He also ordered all the window shades to be lowered. The cash and the chutes were delivered, and the passengers were released. Stewardesses also released, except for Tina Mucklow. Flight crew stayed.
Yeah.
So let's talk about who the flight crew is.
Real briefly, that's three other people. Captain William A. Scott, who unfortunately has passed away by this time. But also First Officer William J. Ratajczak, who is still alive.
Yes, he is.
And Flight Engineer Harold E. Anderson, who I believe is also still alive.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're getting on. They're getting on in years. But besides the delivery of the cash and the parachutes, the plane needed refueling. This would take a lot longer. And so the plane, it actually took four trucks because they had issues with one or two of the trucks. And so it took like four trucks to top off this plane and refuel it. And a little factoid we heard this weekend at CooperCon, it cost $116 to refuel that plane in 1971.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah, those were the days, right? But the plane did not take off from Seattle until 7:40 p.m. So by this time, it was 3 hours past sunset. And plus that bad weather had finally arrived from the north. And so, yes,
it was a dark and stormy night. While the plane was refueling, Cooper told the pilot to plot a course for Mexico City. And he was very specific. He also told them he wanted the plane to fly just above stall speed with the landing gear down and the wing flaps lowered to 15 degrees. He specified a maximum altitude of 10,000 feet and said that he wanted the cabin to remain unpressurized.
Yeah. Now, this is
pretty interesting.
Yeah, this is, again, a source of endless speculation. How much did Cooper know? Did he specify those conditions so that he would know exactly which direction and how the plane was going to fly? Or was it just dumb luck that led him down from Seattle south over Portland?
Well, one thing I learned at CooperCon this weekend was that he must have known something about 727s because they were the only ones Boeing made that had the 15 degrees marker. They were other denominations or whatever you want to call it on the other models. So that's a one way, if we're not going to get into stairs and stuff, that you could say, wow, this guy knew a thing or two about 727s.
Yeah, apparently, that was a standard flap setting for the 727, and other planes have somewhat different ones, like 12 degrees, 13 degrees, 17 degrees, whatever. So
yeah,
he seemed to know something about the 727. So under these conditions, though, the Boeing 727, which was kind of a gas guzzler, that's why they phased it out, actually, it was not going to make it nonstop to Mexico City, not with the landing gear down and the flaps down and all that stuff. No.
That's a lot of drag.
Yeah. And so Cooper was told that they would need to stop to refuel. They suggested either San Francisco or maybe Sacramento or maybe Reno, Nevada. And they settled on Reno.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would choose Reno.
Yeah.
The route chosen was a standard airway known infamously as Victor 23. It goes south from Seattle, parallel to Interstate 5. The route was necessary because the altitude specified by Cooper, no higher than 10,000 feet, made it too dangerous to fly eastward through the Cascades. You'd be hitting a mountain or terrain or whatever.
There are a number of peaks in the Cascades that are way over 10,000 feet.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's another question. Did Cooper plan it this way, knowing that the Cascades were right there?
Mm-hmm.
Was he aware of the existence of the Victor 23 airway? And so he wanted them to take it so he would know exactly where they were flying, so he'd know, have a good clue where he was bailing out of the plane and where he was going to land. Yeah.
Right. I think presumably, so. If you're on Victor 23, which I don't know air line routes, I'm pretty sure I've flown Victor 23 to Seattle the whole way I could see I-5.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm assuming that maybe he wanted Victor 23 because if he knew about it, which I think he might have, because he would have been had a pretty good marker, pretty good idea of where along the way he was. If you're just flying over the forest at night, it's dark. You won't know where you are.
And but
when you
not
see
wanna,
I-5, you'll see towns. You'll see.
Well, yeah. And he didn't want to come down in the wilderness far from anywhere. He wanted to, coming down a few miles from I-5 would be a plus.
It would be a real plus. Yeah.
Yeah, it would be. Let's see, what other specs did he want? He wanted to take off with the rear air stairs deployed and locked in place.
Oof.
Yeah, maybe we should stop here and tell our listeners what the air stairs are all about.
I think you should dive into air stairs because you know more about air stairs than anybody.
The air stairs, yeah. I don't know about anybody, but so the Boeing 727 was unique. There were only a couple of airliners that had this feature, which is there was a set of stairs in the rear of the plane that basically folded down out of the plane. And so it was designed this way for third world airports or smaller airports, even here in the U.S. that didn't have a lot of facilities. They didn't have what do they call those things? Airways, those things that you walk out to the plane on.
Yeah. What do they call them? Stair cars or whatever, like where they just drive up to the side of the plane.
Yeah. So not every airport's going to have those things. And so that's why the air stairs were designed and built into the 727. Cool idea. And actually, a little bit of personal trivia here. I actually got to use the air stairs for the first time ever on a 727 in the year 2000. I caught a flight in South America from Peru to Bolivia.
Wow.
And in La Paz, Bolivia, we exited the plane via the air stairs, which was cool. But that, if you want to know why you never see any 727s anymore, it's because they all got retired and they were sold off to third world airlines on. Still some in service, just not here in the U.S.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I didn't ride on any, but I'm pretty sure when I lived in Costa Rica, and this would be around the exact same time you were down there, it's 99 and 2000, I'm pretty sure I saw some at the airport, in Alajuela Airport.
Yeah, now the last thing about the air stairs is that they're meant, of course, to be lowered when the plane is landed. Nobody in the crew was really aware of any time that anybody had actually tried to lower the air stairs in flight. And they were wondering about that. But apparently they called the home office on the radio and said, can that be done? And the home office came back and says, yeah, we talked to Boeing. Boeing says, sure.
Yeah.
But you can't take off with them locked in place. That would be dangerous. But you can lower them in flight. And so that's what it is. It's a hydraulic system. There's a lever at the top of the stairs that the flight attendant would push towards the back of the plane, and that causes the stairs to drop. And then you go down, to the bottom of the stairs, turn around and grab these bars that hang down that hold it, that they're suspended by, and grab those and pull them towards you and lock them into place. And then they're ready for the passengers. So, and then when you want to raise them, you just go back up to the top and pull that lever the other way, and wah, they're closed. Easy.
That's great. Yeah, cool.
So anyway, there we go. So that's where we're at now. Okay, so Cooper wanted the air stairs to be down and locked in place.
Mm. Yeah.
So because they felt that it would be dangerous to take off with the stairs down, Cooper relented and said that he would just lower the stairs after takeoff. So he was a reasonable guy.
Then DB busied himself cannibalizing one of the reserve chutes.
Hmm.
So the money bag, just say what you're talking about this money bag instead of the knapsack that he wanted.
Yeah. Well, one of his demands is he wanted the money put in a knapsack, like a little backpack. Mm-hmm. And instead, when it was delivered, it was just in a canvas bank bag, like the ones they put cash in, large one. And so he needed to tie that up. So what he did is he opened up one of the reserve parachutes and pulled the canopy out and cut away all the, this is one of the big mysteries. And this is another weird little mystery that we still haven't figured out, is that he pulled out a pocket knife and cut all the parachute cord loose from the container. That's the little pack that the whole thing is packed in. They call it the container.
Right.
He cut it all away But he left this, there's a yoke in where all the, they all attach to. Instead of just cutting the yoke and pulling them all off the yoke, which would have been quick and easy, he instead individually cut each parachute cord where it loops around that yoke. He cut each one of those loops instead, which is still a big puzzler. And I've talked to, I was just talking to Tom Kay, one of the preeminent Cooperologists out there yesterday about that. He mentioned that, and we were both shaking our head over that. And I suggested that perhaps Cooper was maybe OCD. We still don't understand why he did that. But anyway, he cuts all that loose, and then he takes two pieces of parachute cord, cuts about 170 feet long, cuts them away from the chute, and uses one to tie the mouth of the bag shut. And then, well, of course, he's got a lot of excess cord. He wraps that around the bag in one direction, and then in another direction, and then around the middle, and until he had it in a nice, tight little bundle. And then he used the other piece of parachute cord. He wrapped that several times around his waist, making himself kind of a little belt, and then tied that to the bag. So he had a nice little improvised sort of carrying system for all of his money. Yeah. And also just one last aside too, is also there was, if you look at the Wikipedia page about this, it says that two pieces of parachute cord were taken from that reserve chute, but actually Cooper took five pieces. There are actually three other pieces that were taken out of that parachute. Nobody knows why. Yeah, it is interesting. What did he need with those, all that extra parachute cord? I wonder.
I don't have any idea. Yeah. You also want to talk about the training chute?
Oh, yeah. So the training chute, and actually we saw a copy of that yesterday. I don't know if you posted a picture on Instagram yet or not. I haven't gotten around to doing it. I guess I should do that, huh? The other chute what do you think that weighed? About 15, 20 pounds, maybe?
Nah, not even, maybe 15.
Okay. But anyway, that was kind of small, compact. But again, it was a training chute only. I think it's when at the jump school, then they would train people how to put the parachute on and stuff.
Right. You might have seen a video of this where they have people do, I guess you call them dry jumps, where they jump out of the airplane onto a like airbag thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, yeah. So anyway, they're just to train people, especially the military is especially going to do this. Cause like if people are flying along and they've got like, they've got to really put those chutes on quickly because their plane is going down. So you want people to have some practice doing that. Anyway, so that's what this thing was for. But it clearly said training chute only on it. It was clearly labeled. And yet it was gone. When the plane landed in Reno, it was gone. And so weird. Which has touched off a lot of speculation. Well, did Cooper really know what he was doing? Did he tie that thing to himself thinking that it was a functioning reserve chute? And if so, that must indicate that he was incompetent and a novice as a skydiver, which I don't buy into personally. I think that Cooper, just because it was gone doesn't mean he took it with him or that he actually thought it was a functioning chute personally. But some people are still going on today thinking that Cooper was an amateur who didn't really know what he was doing when it came to parachutes. And I disagree, but no, well, I'm just an opinionated
guy. Yeah, I'm kind of with you, Joe. I don't know much about parachuting, and I also sometimes feel like overall, I'd say I agree with you.
Yeah, I think he knew what he was doing. So he just had a different use for that thing that we don't know about.
Yeah. So Tina Mucklow, this is the stewardess, flight attendant, as we call them now, was with Cooper when he was cutting up the reserve chute and strapping on his parachute. She observed that he seemed confident and seemed to know what he was doing.
Yeah, and when he was putting on the parachute, right?
Right. I mean, like, I've never been parachuting, not even tandem jumping for a birthday or whatever. If you gave me a military parachute, I might be able to figure it out. I'm a smart guy, but it's not going to be like click, 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 just go for it.
Well, yeah, and this was an older model. And actually there was some discussion about that too. Some people were saying like that they were handed this same exact parachute and told to put it on. And they struggled to do it because it's got a really weird system for hooking the straps together across your chest. And, they had a hard time figuring it out, but apparently Cooper didn't have that issue. He put it right on.
So just before the plane took off, he told her to go to the flight deck.
AKA the cockpit.
Right.
Yeah.
So she's up there with the pilot and the flight engineer, and she was to pull the curtain between first class and coach closed and then close the door to the cockpit. None of the crew was to open that door under any circumstances.
So it appears to me he didn't want them to know when or where he jumped out of the plane, right?
Exactly, or what he did next. There may have been something he was doing on the plane. I mean, I don't know what that would be, but he didn't want any further observation of his activities.
Mm-hmm. So he was doing something sneaky back there.
Something. It's about 8 p.m. The plane is still climbing, and Cooper deployed the air stairs. The crew guessed this because the indicator light came on in the cockpit. At about 8:12 p.m., the crew reported oscillations in cabin pressure.
Whoa.
Doing something with the air stairs. So that's a quote from them?
Yeah. That's from the there's actually two transcripts of this. There were communications via radio between the plane and the tower in actually more than one tower, because they passed by a number of different airports. But there was a radio transmission, and there was also a teletype communication system that I think was used for just direct communications with the home office.
Oh,
so this message actually was in the transcript for the teletype.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, they didn't. I think maybe it might have been that they decided they didn't want that going out on the open air for some reason. They didn't want people knowing.
Play this out for a youngster like me. Yeah. I barely know what a teletype is, and I'm not sure how this would work on an airplane. Would they be typing on a keyboard?
Yeah, that's what teletypes were. It was like you type something in, and then it would be encoded in radio. I guess Morse code or something similar to Morse code. And it's sent to the other end, and a receiver gets it and then decrypts it and types it out, just like you would see something being typed out on a typewriter.
Right. So it turns it into a signal.
Yeah.
And it translates it directly from keystrokes in a keyboard. So somewhere up in that cockpit, there was a keyboard, like on your computer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they
That's had what I was suspecting.
Yeah. So they had those redundant communication systems. But again, like I said, there was a guy yesterday saying he couldn't find it in the radio transcript, and that's why it's not in the radio transcript. It's in the other transcript, the teletype. Yeah. So, yeah, the private line between Cooper. And, of course, it wasn't just the guys at the home office. By that time, of course, the FBI was there reading the transmissions, too. But so this is about 8:12 when this happened, the famous pressure pump when he jumped out of the plane, these oscillations in cabin pressure, which were caused by the air stairs bouncing up and down. Because when he deployed the air stairs, the train was traveling about 170 knots. This is according to the radio transmissions. That's what the most recent speed they had reported. And that's about 195, 200 miles an hour. So the airflow would have prevented the air stairs from lowering very far. They're supposed to drop down to an angle, about a 45-degree angle. Mm-hmm. But they would have been practically level. But when Cooper goes to leave the plane, his weight as he went out further on the stairs would have caused the stairs to extend downward because of that weight. And then when he jumped off the stairs would snap back up. And then they would over travel and bounce a few times. And this is what created the oscillations in the cabin pressure that the crew noticed. And again, this became known as the pressure bump to Cooperologists. And by the way, these conditions were confirmed. It was the FBI some days later took the same exact plane up with Harold Anderson, the flight engineer. They took the plane up again, and they had built these sort of sleds. They were just basically half crates with runners on the bottom, and they filled them with sandbags and to about a 230-pound weight and pushed a couple of them out the back of the plane. And it really worked. There's actually some planes flying alongside taking video of this thing. You can see these things exiting the plane, and the stairs go boop downward, and these things slide off, and then you can see the stairs popping back up and bouncing a few times. That's how they figured that this has to be where Cooper jumped out of the plane.
So if you haven't already, I would really strongly encourage you, obviously not if you're driving or even walking, but at some point where you're safe, look up the air stairs on a 727
because I think photos out there.
Yeah, you can see lots of pictures of them. They were a very common airplane in their day. I really want you to do this because I don't have a fear of heights or whatever. I've never been skydiving, but I would do it.
Mm-hmm.
There's something to me about the way that DB Cooper would have had to jump out of this plane that for me would have been even more scary than your standard jump out of an airplane.
That's another reason why I think that Cooper was a seasoned veteran, maybe a former paratrooper or special ops guy, but at least he had a lot of experience because there's no way I'd be able to make myself jump off those stairs in the pitch darkness on a stormy night.
The jump is not so much what scares me, Joe. It would be the process of walking down those stairs
And that like would be scary.
Yeah. Right, so you're going down the stairs, just like when you Google it, which you should, and you look at those stairs and imagine that, but instead of leading down onto a runway or whatever, it's leading down into oblivion. And the wind, the vortexes and stuff that would be coming up from the turbulence that's just generated by the plane's motion would be so intense that you would have to have some sand to walk down there. And if it wasn't your first rodeo, I think you might get spooked.
Yeah, no, I agree. It would be really, really scary. But
I guess just take this away if you're not able to look up the plane. Just take this away that it would be much scarier than just jumping out a hatch and flying off into the air. It'd be an act you have to do where you're walking downstairs into a storm, into really powerful, 120 mile an hour winds, they were saying at CooperCon.
A lot more than that. I mean, the plane was going about 200 miles an hour. So effectively, we're talking about 200 miles an hour.
Just air at that point, airflow at that point, it's 200.
But it's gonna hit you hard.
Winds and shear. Yeah, it's going to be really intense.
Definitely. Yeah, but he did it anyway. But based on the plane's course and where they in its airspeed and et cetera, they believe he bailed out perhaps as far south as Battleground, Washington, or not too far north of Battleground.
But that's the southern limit of what the FBI has estimated. I think their official jump point is probably closer to Ariel, Washington, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Which is substantially north. My dad's from Battleground, and I spent a lot of time on the Lewis River, and I know where Ariel is. So it's a long drive.
Yeah, it is. And so, probably it was further north than that. And of course, his landing point would have been further north still, but depending on when he opened the chute. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the longer he free falls, the further south he lands, right? Mm-hmm. Because the wind was blowing from the southwest to the northeast that night.
Right.
So if he pops the chute right after he leaves the plane, then he would have drifted quite a ways to the northeast. That's why the landing zone, as defined by the estimated by the FBI, is a pretty big geographical area.
It's a big circle. Yeah,
it is. Yeah, it really is. So where are we at here? So the plane goes on, of course. They're under strict orders not to go back and look in the cabin, even though they sort of wondered if perhaps he bailed out of the plane. They didn't know for sure, so they didn't dare go back and check. So on they went to Reno. They flew south, down past Eugene into California, eventually sort of bent around to the east and wound up landing in Reno at about 10:15 that night. Mm-hmm. And the runway, of course, was very surrounded by law enforcement. We're talking police, Reno police, all the county sheriffs, all the FBI, and anybody else who, they could rustle up, because they weren't sure if he was still on the plane or not. Of course, they wanted to be ready to shoot his butt,
But, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Well, shoot his butt or stop him from lighting off that bomb he had.
Yeah, or something. But yeah.
Whatever he was going to do, right? Like,
yeah. That was, because when I first was researching the story, I was kicking around the possibility that he just stayed on the plane and just skipped down the stairs and just sort of laid low and just, belly crawled off the runway and into the bushes. I mean, I didn't think that was a serious, realistic possibility.
I mean, there are people out there, Joe, if you're spending time on those internets that are really popular today, there are people who think that he was so familiar with 727s that he found a compartment, hid in it, and then made it all the way, I think, back to Seattle, I think is how this theory goes, before he was able to get off when the FBI was not looking so carefully at the plane.
Yeah, there are people who think that. I don't buy that at all. But
I think, if you look at the documents, and I haven't read every, they call them 302s, every, recently publicized or whatever document that's come out, there are documents, though, that you can find that detail how thoroughly the FBI went through the plane. I don't know that there's anywhere he could have hidden. Well, you know what I mean? That a man would fit in that they didn't at least take a peek in.
Yeah, no, I think that if there's a guy named Bruce Campbell, not the actor, but another guy who owns a 727. He lives outside of Hillsboro. Mm-hmm. And I went up there and checked it out. He's a very friendly guy, real nice guy. I do implore you, if you want to go look at it, contact him first and make sure it's okay. Don't just show up. That's rude. But
yeah,
anyway. No. But you can't go out there. He welcomes visitors, but you should call ahead but anyway, I took a look at it and he, in some places he's pulled up the flooring and put down heavy plexiglass. So you can sort of see down below what's going on underneath the deck there. And there is kind of a space down there where there's like cables and hydraulics and stuff for controlling the tail and the flaps and stuff. There is a space down there that would definitely would have been big enough for him to hide in. But I'm pretty sure that, you know, the cops thought of that. And then they also brought dogs along with them too. So
they brought dogs. And also, yeah. I don't know specifically about the 727, but about every aircraft that I've ever looked into for, you know, was it Flight 983, everything I've researched about airplanes, they make these things so that there's no place you can have an electrical failure and you can't just move a panel and get in there to work.
Mm.
So it's as simple as bringing whatever appropriate Allen wrench or key or whatever it is it takes to get those things unbolted and go in there and look in each compartment. And it's not that hard to do. And it's done frequently as part of routine maintenance on the plane. So I don't think that there's a good place that DB Cooper was going to be able to hide on the plane. So let's just put that one to bed.
Yeah. Although I have my alternative theory, which I don't take very seriously, but what if Cooper was actually Reno police? And if underneath his suit and his tie, he was wearing his Reno police uniform.
Right.
He either, maybe he shows up in the plane, you know, after they're on board the plane, he pops up out of his hidey hole and stands there behind them when they look around. Oh, hi, Dan. How's it going? Yeah, I didn't know you were working tonight. Oh, yeah. So right. I don't actually take that seriously.
It's like that movie, The Professional. What's his name? Jean Reno's character escapes by grabbing a guy and stripping his clothes off and just walking out there in the SWAT team uniform. Gas mask.
I know. Yeah, no,
That's Hollywood. I don't think it's very realistic.
It's a fun theory, but I don't think that's what happened. That would have been a risky way of going about it. Plus, he would have had to explain that big canvas money bag he's holding.
I'm just a responding officer with a bag that happens to weigh exactly 22.1 pounds.
What do you say is in there? What's in the bag there, Dan? SWAT supplies. I don't know.
It's my cop things. I need them to cop.
Yeah, it's cop stuff. Yeah.
How would I police with that? My police stuff in my police bag, my police duffel bag. Don't look.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, guys, I'm going to go for donuts, guys. Anybody want anything? Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, look, it's my break. Bye. Yeah.
Break time. See ya.
Yeah. Cooper was not on the 727 when it landed.
No.
But he did leave behind a really important souvenir, which was a cheap JCPenney's clip-on tie with a pearl tie tack. Ooh, that's classy.
Yeah. The FBI still has it. There's pictures. You can see pictures on the interwebs of this actual tie front and back.
That's in the National Archives now.
I think. Yeah. I assume it is. I mean, I don't know if they turned every last little bit of Cooper evidence over to the archives or not.
Where did Tom Kay get the tie from? He got to look at the tie.
He was involved with the FBI prior to when they closed the case. They closed the case in 2016, and that's when they supposedly sent everything to the National Archives. But Tom Kay was with this group called Citizen Sleuths, and there were three of them, him and two other people. And I don't know if they were recruited by Larry Carr. So Larry Carr was Special Agent Larry Carr of the FBI. Mm-hmm. Who actually got himself assigned to Seattle and got to be special agent in charge of the Cooper investigation for a while. And he really wanted to revive this case. It was kind of moribund. He wanted to revive it. And so I don't know if he found these guys and recruited them or if they called him and volunteered. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly how it happened. You can learn a lot about Larry Carr and the Citizen Sleuths if you read Jeffrey Gray's book, Skyjack. Which I have a copy of. Have you read it?
I have. Yeah, I own 3 DB Cooper books. That's the only one I've read.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah, it's like it's a great introduction to the case, I think. So
it was one of the first where they really had good, right? That was one of the first ones that came out that was like, this is actually good research, not just kind of sensationalism or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it was. He definitely spent a lot of time talking to Tom Kay and Larry Carr and a lot of other people. And of course, he describes some of the Cooperologists. Some of the people are very smart that are pursuing this, the amateur sleuths and stuff. But there are a few crackpots out there as well.
So based on the plane's sort of estimated position at 8:12 p.m. They're saying Cooper jumped out of the plane at least several miles south of the Lewis River.
At least.
And this is quite a ways north of Vancouver. And prevailing winds that night were southwesterly. That means they were blowing southwest to northeast.
Yeah.
And that he would have drifted northeast, maybe as far as the Lewis River, depending on how far he fell before he deployed his parachute, which, remember, was not on any type of altimeter or timer or whatever. He had to pull it manually himself.
And actually, I got to say, free falling in the dark on a cloudy, moonless night when you can't see how close that ground is, free falling for very long would be a little dicey for me.
Under 10,000 feet. Do you know the exact altitude he jumped from?
They were at about 10,000 feet.
Okay, and, right about 10,000 feet. So that's a pretty low dive.
It is. And actually, that's 10,000 feet. I'm not sure exactly what the height of the terrain is.
That's true. It's 10,000 feet above sea level. So down the terrain was. Yeah.
And so you can't be free falling too terribly long. Mm-hmm. But it says there are people actually who think that he did drift as far as the Lewis River, and that people think he actually came down in the river and drowned.
It's possible.
Yeah. Possible, I don't think so, but there was somebody way back when who went so far as to deploy a small research submarine in Lake Merwin is one of the lakes up there.
It's a reservoir.
There's actually several dams up there and more than one reservoir.
Merwin and one other.
Yeah. And
I know them very well.
Yeah. And so people have actually explored those looking for the remains of Cooper and his money bag and his parachute and found exactly zilch.
Nothing.
There's been a lot of effort searching that whole area for any sign of him, and a scrap of anything has been found.
And I don't want to get out over my skis and jump ahead into theories and stuff, but a big part of the reason why I am of the opinion, basically I would go two ways and say either Cooper landed somewhere totally crazy and died, or he got out of there. And I can tell you this because, like, when we're saying things like Cougar and Merwin Dam, the Lewis River, Ariel, Washington, if you're not from this area, it sounds like, you know, we don't know what we're talking about. This could be the middle of nowhere. And there are places like that in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
But I spent a lot of time camping at Cougar, playing in the water at Merwin Dam, boating at that area.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you can do this stuff. They're swimming around on inner tubes. If any part of that would have come to the surface or washed up on the lake, you'd be in the heart of a tourist area. The forests around the Lewis River Valley, they are logged. They are hunted. There are tourists, campers, all manner of people. Now we've got drones. Pilots fly over there all the time. This is not, you know, the Alaskan bush that you're landing in.
That's the thing is there's plenty of people out there in those woods. And so, definitely I don't think he augured in and died on landing or anything like that because he would have been found.
I mean, I think we can talk more like a theory thing, but I think the only way that could happen is if he was a no-pull and he just shot down into a brush pile at a million miles an hour. That's it.
But if a chute deployed, he definitely would have been found, especially because the canopy in that parachute that he took is a white canopy, highly visible.
Yeah.
So actually, hang on. Can we take a quick break? Because I am suddenly feeling this need to answer the call of nature.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
You've worked hard for what you have, your money, your assets, your 401k, and home. Isn't it all worth protecting? Nearly one in four consumers have been a victim of identity theft. LifeLock Ultimate Plus helps protect your finances with up to $3 million in reimbursement. LifeLock alerts you to identity threats you might miss. And if your identity is stolen, your dedicated U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. Let LifeLock help protect what you've worked so hard for. Save 25% off your first year on LifeLock Ultimate Plus at LifeLock.com/aware. Terms apply.
Law enforcement and troops from Fort Lewis, about 200 of them, scoured the landing zone and found nothing. I mean, nothing. Not so much as a broken twig that they could attribute to Cooper.
Yeah.
They also use aircraft to search the Victor 23 flight path, the one that leads south out of Seattle down to Reno, and also nothing. They didn't find anything.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI devoted a huge amount of resources to trying to track Cooper down, and eventually they concluded that he'd died in his jump the night of the skyjacking. And, I mean, this does make a kind of sense. I mean, if Cooper was alive, the FBI would have caught him, right?
Oh, yeah, if you're the FBI, you're going to think that way, for sure. But also, none of the ransom money ever showed up in circulation.
See, this is the best case for the FBI's theory.
Yeah, this is actually supportive of it, because they actually published those. I mean, they were not only were those bills, serial numbers, circulated to all the banks in the Pacific Northwest. I think the entire West Coast, actually, but also the local papers in Seattle and Portland and other places published all of the numbers, and they mm-hmm. published all of those, and they posted a reward of like $1,000 to the first person who turned in a DB Cooper bill.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it wasn't just the banks that were scouring their $20 bills. It was like a lot of just regular people like you and me mm-hmm. that were scouring those things.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And none of it ever turned up.
Yeah. Ever. Even to this day, just so we're clear. Except.
Yeah. Except. Well, yeah, there was that.
There is a big except. Some of the money did turn up. On February 10th of 1980, an 8-year-old kid named Brian Ingram was hanging out with his family on a beach just northwest of Vancouver. This beach is called Tina Bar, and mm-hmm. it's on the east bank of the Columbia River after it bends around to the north, which isn't super important to the story, but if you're from here, you know exactly where that is.
Yeah.
When Brian was digging around in the sand, he found 3 packets of Cooper's $20 bills.
Mm-hmm. 100 bills in each.
Yep. Yep. They were somewhat rotted around the edges, but the serial numbers were still legible. The bills totaled about $5,800, or I think exactly that much. The 3 bundles of 100 bills, but someone, Cooper, appeared to have pulled out 10 bills for some reason.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Why? Yeah, it's an odd thing, and man, there's a lot. So we were saying at KuperCon, sorry to get on another aside, but we were saying at KuperCon, the story of the money is almost like its own mystery unto mm-hmm. itself, nearly it separate is. From this brazen skyjacking. There are so many weird things about this money.
A lot of people have expended a lot of time, pondering how the money got there. A lot of outlandish theories have been put forward. I personally have my own idea. We'll talk about that in a sec. But mm-hmm. just first of all, I mean, the first mystery for me was why did Cooper pull out 10 bills?
Okay.
Why was that? I pondered that question for quite a bit. But several years ago, I think it was 2018, maybe, I don't know, somewhere around there, I attended a Cooper conference where I met Bruce A. Smith, who was the author of a book about D.B. Cooper. It's called D.B. Cooper and the FBI. He is a leading Cooperologist. And he was giving a little talk, his little TED talk there. And he said that actually, Brian Ingram was actually given some of those bills. He got to keep some of them since he found them, and mm-hmm. he auctioned them off and got quite a bit of money for them. But when they took them to the auction house, those guys were apparently big pros. The FBI, of course, had looked these bills over quite carefully, but the guys at the auction house apparently were better. And they found that some of these bills were actually 2 bills. Mm-hmm. They were bills that were stuck together, and they peeled them apart. So they were actually, it was actually more than $5,800. It was essentially, it looks like it was at least $6,000. Bruce thought it might be more than $6,000. So apparently I had wasted a lot of time pondering this whole question of why there were only $5,800 in $20 bills there.
Well,
so this is, by the way, what you can look forward to if you get into the whole Cooper vortex thing.
It's true. It's true. Yeah. If it's more than an even amount, that also changes things. So I'm kind of upset that the FBI wasn't able to get a better count on it. I mean, it does seem like they kind of dropped the ball.
Yeah.
Because if it's an exact amount that you would expect the bank to bail them in, which I think should lead you to even thousands, you'd expect to see 6,000.
Yeah.
But if it's more or less by any amount, I mean, someone took some bills out of there. Or put some in, and that actually changes a lot since they were bundling them in even denominations, right?
Yeah.
Even amounts, at least. Yeah. So that means that changes something, even if it's just something small. So let's not spend too much time on that, but I do think that's fascinating. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to point out, too, that it's a moving target. On the first time I looked this up on Wikipedia, it was at $5,800. They since have changed it. I went back and looked at it for the first time in years. Somebody went in there and changed the amount from $5,800 to $5,880. I don't ask me why, which, again, is not correct. This is, again, the frustration of the Cooper thing is how many bills were there? Probably 6,000, almost certainly, but you can't really pin it down for 100%.
Right.
But I was wondering about it. The reason I was wondering about it is I was wondering if Cooper was trying to tell us something, because I believe Cooper left some money there. So did the number 58 have some significance? Ooh, you know, but no, apparently not. But the thing about it is that, as we said, it spawned a lot of theories. The money on Tina Bar caused, for one thing, the birth of the Washougal washdown theory. Mm. Yes. Not my favorite theory personally, but a lot of other people like it a lot.
People who have not visited the Washougal River like this a lot.
Yeah, but apparently it was decided that the plane, the pilot or the co-pilot said right after the money find that the plane actually may have been off course somewhat to the east, which could have put Cooper's bailout somewhere over the Washougal River watershed east of Vancouver. Well, and so a lot of people thought this is how the money might have gotten there, is that he augured into the forest somewhere in the watershed. And over the years, somehow the money bag got separated. Maybe during the fall itself, it was torn away from his body. And then the money bag is sort of rolls down a hillside, maybe gets into a little stream, is pushed downstream, and eventually winds up washing into the Washougal River itself, which runs basically from north to south, and it feeds into the Columbia River. So eventually it makes its way into the Columbia River, the money bag, that is, and sort of tumbles along the bottom of the river for miles past Vancouver and Portland and around the bend northward till it gets to about Tina Bar, where three packets of bills separated themselves from the herd and established a little bit of positive buoyancy and floated up onto the beach. That is the Washougal washdown theory. Now, does that work for you?
No, it doesn't. And I'm going to tell you why, because I've been to the Washougal River and it's beautiful country up there. If you have a chance to go, check it out. It's amazing. I hear the fishing's really great up there, but it's a pretty small little river and its tributaries are, for the most part, really small themselves. So this theory requires a whole duffel bag, which was probably tied to something larger, probably, but I guess we don't know that, and enough money to weigh 22 pounds to get just sort of pushed along in this way and never become snagged. There are a lot of snags on the Washougal River.
Good luck with that, right?
Right. You could. I defy you. Walk up, there is, find something that weighs 22 pounds and just drop it in the Washougal River and see if it ever shows up on Tina Bar.
Yeah, I got to tell you, there. I got to tell you, too, having spent a lot of time on the river around here, there is a lot of stuff on the bottom of that river. There's a lot of snags down there, a lot of trees, waterlogged trees that are sitting on the bottom of the river.
Right.
So nothing, no money bag is going to go for any length of period down any of the rivers around here. It's going to get hung up on something.
I would need the Washougal washdown theory for me to even take it seriously. I'd need someone with a lot of understanding of river dynamics to get out some complicated hydrodynamic flow charts or whatever to explain to me how that would be possible. You don't see this happen all that much, especially when you have something that's not super buoyant. You know, if for some reason this money was special dollars that floated that had a lot of buoyancy to them,
maybe.
But and then you also get into where it's buried. It's where it's buried on Tina Bar is really far up the beach.
It's actually, well above the even the high water mark in wintertime.
There are some floods that could take it there, but you're relying on a lot of water pressure to do a lot of weird things. And I just take my word for it. If you go to the Washougal River and just take a look at any point along that river, you're going to see a river that's full of rocks, full of snags, is not very deep, and is not generally going to be able to do that. Then you have your own issues when you get to the Columbia. I don't embrace this theory at all.
Oh, no, not at all. Of course, the alternative that was that he fell into the Lewis River and the money somehow washed downstream and into the Columbia. But the problem with that is the Lewis River dumps into the Columbia about 9 miles downstream from Tina Bar. So how did the money make it up? And there was actually one theory put forward. I don't think it was entirely put forward in all seriousness, but that perhaps a ship was chugging along upstream and somehow managed to hook the money bag.
Yeah.
And drag it upstream for 9 miles. Okay. But that's pretty far-fetched.
But also, it's far-fetched. That's the best explanation I've heard. I haven't heard that before. That's the best I've heard anyone say.
Yeah. And there's that one. But the problem is, of course, is how does it get down to the Columbia? Because as we mentioned, there are several dams on the Lewis River.
Yep.
And again, the Lewis River is not a mighty river either. It's kind of like the Washougal.
I would believe that at flood stage, the Lewis River could force something like that down into the Columbia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But like you said, it's going to hit dams and reservoirs.
Yeah.
And there are many more than just the two we talked about with the big reservoirs behind them. There are flood controls all along the Lewis River because the Lewis River Valley used to flood. And now we have floodgates that control, which work like very small dams, would get stopped there. And then, how does it get upstream? The Columbia River, if you don't know, it is, by some estimations, about the seventh largest river in the world. It is big and massive. And while it looks like a lazy river, it's actually moving pretty quick out there. Mm-hmm. And for the money to be able to swim upstream like a salmon is pretty nuts.
Seriously nuts. I mean, you ever look at a salmon who do swim upstream? They're pretty damn muscular.
They are. They are. No, I'm not.
They're stronger than they look, you know?
They are. I had one. I'll cut this out. This is for you, not for the audience. But I had a steelhead hit me in the shin so hard, I can still feel where it struck me. I think I was 12 or 11 when that happened.
Oh, wow. Really?
That's how, because they bump into those rocks. Anyway, all right. So snap. But yeah, it hurt like hell. This has also caused others to speculate that the plane was actually off course to the west and Cooper landed on or near Tina Bar.
Mm-hmm.
One guy, should we say his name?
No, it's not the same guy you're thinking about. You're thinking about Eric, right?
I'm thinking of Eric Ulis. Okay, all right.
No, it's actually, this is a different guy some years back that did this, yeah.
One guy spent a pretty large amount of money dragging the river there looking for Cooper's remains or a bag of money, anything he could find, and he didn't find anything.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And of course, there's a guy right now, actually, Eric Ulis was the guy who organized CooperCon this past weekend.
I really wanted an interview with him. I'm sorry he didn't come up.
Yeah, Eric's a real nice guy. He believes that Cooper landed on Tina Bar and buried his parachute and the money there. And he's actually got a little project going now searching the area, looking for this stuff. I mean, I personally think he's barking up the wrong tree.
I'm glad he's doing it. I don't know if I think he's going to find anything, but I'm glad he's out there doing it. I'd be interested to know.
Yeah, no, I mean, who knows? Maybe he'll turn out to be right. I don't know. The problem I have with it is he's thinking that perhaps Cooper landed there and buried his parachute there and hid the money, maybe buried the money as well. One of the problems I have with the bury the parachute theory is that why would he do that when he's got the river right there? You know, I mean, what I would do is bundle up my whole parachute and everything and put some heavy rocks in there and tie the whole thing into a nice tight little bundle and throw it in the river. I wouldn't bury it, you know? And remember, Cooper was not trying to make it disappear forever. He just wanted to evade law enforcement for a little while. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as burying the money, burying this money in on a sandy beach, it just seems like a very bad idea to me. I would much rather myself, if I couldn't carry the money, which that would be the first option, of course, I would hide it in the bushes or something. At least find a piece of more solid ground, like, and maybe bury it under some rocks or something. I wouldn't bury it on a sandy beach.
I'm just going to say straight out, I looked up, there's a website you can go to. I don't remember the name, but you look it up. You can see like, how much does money weigh? And it will show you the weight and volume. You just enter in what it is, $20,000 in 20s. They're a gram a pop.
Yeah.
And you can see how big that would be.
It's about 22 pounds, right?
It's 22.1 pounds, and you can carry it in your arms, no problem.
Oh, yeah.
I don't understand why D.B. Cooper, if he were within a couple miles of downtown Vancouver, Washington, wouldn't just take off running with that under his arm. That's the smartest, most obvious play, especially if you have any idea where you are, right?
Mm-hmm.
I suppose maybe he's an idiot and he thought Tina Bar was the middle of nowhere when it turns out he was just outside of town.
Yeah.
But if you're anywhere near a roadway, if you think you have any chance of escape, friggin' put that cash under your arm and run off with it. It's not like he has $1 million in ones and he can't move it, or it's going to be really obvious that he has it. You might be able to stuff that into your, well, not really into your pockets, but like, you know, maybe keep it just on your person secretively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, if you wore the right kind of clothing with a lot of pockets, you could maybe conceivably.
Or keep it in a bag. It won't even look that suspicious in a little duffel bag.
No, exactly. So yeah, I don't, but let's, the other thing though, is like, if you accept the idea that he buried the money there, Why did he split off three packets of bills and bury those in the middle of the beach where they were found years later? Why did he do that? If he buried them there also, why did he not come back for it? Although maybe he did it.
Maybe he did it squirrel style.
Buried it all over the place.
Buried it all over the place. And he just missed a few.
Yeah, but that's such a bad idea, you know, because to do it that way, because you're if you bury it in like say 20 different places, you know, there's just that 20, you know, there's that many more opportunities for somebody to stumble across it, which is not something you want. And so, because that would let people know, I mean, what happened when the money was found in 1980 brought law enforcement in like bam, you know, like moths to a light.
Yeah. I know exactly what you're saying. So like, this is a way to really throw people off.
Yeah. I don't know, but,
you've got 41 years later, you've got Eric Ulis tearing that beach apart and there may be nothing there.
Yeah, I suspect there is nothing there. I think, because I personally think that when it comes to the money, I think people are kind of asking the wrong question. The question everybody is asking is, how did the money get there? Mm-hmm. My question is, why did the money get there?
There has to be a why, right? I mean, so like, there has to be some intent of some kind.
Because somebody put it there. I mean, the thing about it is, I don't think we mentioned this yet, but the money was found buried just a couple inches down in the sand.
And yeah, it was not deep.
Yeah, three packets of bills stacked on top of one another. No, crosswise. And
thank you for bringing that up, by the way, Joe, because I think that's really important.
Oh, it is, when we're talking
about the Tina Bar discovery. If they found it 6 feet down, because for some reason they were digging a trench on the beach in the middle of February for no reason, I'd be inclined to say that's a slam dunk case that Cooper buried it there, or that, I guess, the dredge theory or whatever.
Yeah.
We're not even going to get into that, but a couple inches. That's crazy. Why would it be there?
Yeah. No, there's no reason. There's just no natural way that the money got there. I mean, people have also said, maybe Cooper buried it or hid it somewhere, and then some wild animal, like a coyote or something, came across the stash and maybe carried the bills to the spot on the beach where it was found. Okay, that's outlandish, too.
And that's crazy. That doesn't make any sense. Yeah, I mean,
obviously.
I mean, really dismissive, but that's nuts.
Obviously, somebody put the money there, and I don't see who else could have put it there other than Cooper. I mean, somebody said, well, maybe somebody found the whole money bag full of it, and they took three packets of bills and buried it on the beach there to be found as a diversion. And no, that makes no sense either. You find it, and you take it to, I don't know, where, Cuba or Canada or wherever, and just spend it. I don't know, but, you know, or turn it over to law enforcement and collect a reward. I don't know, but you don't find the big money bag and take three packets of bills and go bury them on the beach. That doesn't make any sense either.
The only
thing that makes sense is Cooper, or maybe somebody who knew Cooper, burying the money there as a way to tweak us. Remember, this was years after the FBI declared the case more almost closed, and said that they believed with near 100% certitude that Cooper had died the night of the hijacking. And maybe Cooper just decided, well, ha ha, I'm going to show these idiots. I'm going to put some money where they can find it and restart the whole thing.
To me, Joe, that sounds crazy. And yet I honestly cannot come up with a better theory than that.
Me neither.
I would really like to. And I've thought about it actually more than most of the other kind of side alleys, blind alleys you can go down in this case. I've thought a lot about how that money could have got there and tried to come up with a reason other than Cooper put it there. And the only thing I can think of, and it still doesn't answer all the questions, is if somebody else put it there so that they could keep the rest of Cooper's money that they found.
Yeah.
So in this case, theory, right, Cooper crashes down, gets killed. Some hunter finds 200,000 and then is like, well, I'm just going to throw everybody off the trail. And then, of course, off of me, I'm going to bury some of my find out on this random place and then keep everybody looking over there instead of where I was. And then I can spend the money. And the problem with that is that he doesn't seem to have spent the money.
Well, he didn't. And again, it doesn't, as a diversion, it doesn't really make sense. I think the way to, if you're not really sure if it's safe to spend the money, then to go and pass a couple of bills at a store that you don't normally frequent. Go and pass them at that, and then come back a week later or something like that. And, you know, and just sort of say something, oh, how's it going with you? Have been any excitement around here lately? You know, or something like that. And, well, the FBI did sort of come down on us because of, you know, something, you know. I mean, maybe you could do something like that. I don't know. But again, you know, as planting it there still doesn't make much sense, you know?
Yeah. I've thought so much about the money, and one of the things that makes me crazy that I've looked into is I really think that if over the last 50 years someone had spent any substantial amount of that money, at least some of it would have come back to Treasury. Even if they were doing it in some place like North Korea.
Yeah.
I still think some of that would have eventually, through all the weird means, and you can look up, there's like YouTube videos and documentaries that the U.S. Treasury Department themselves puts out about weird bills that have been washing around, you know, the Middle East for 40 years that then show up in Washington, D.C. after going through all kinds of other different countries.
Yeah.
They're all out of date and they have to pull them out of circulation, and they do that.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too.
I'm not saying they get all of them, but that they've got not even one.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too, is that maybe it went overseas to a place like Cuba, which has a huge black market economy in dollars. I mean, people prefer dollars down there. And I was thinking, but like you said, sooner or later, one of them is going to find its way out of there and back to the U.S. And,
one of them comes here from Cuba or whatever, even one of them, then we have some idea, but not one of them has.
This is why a lot of people tend to believe that Cooper did not do it for the money. So
I think he was not in it for the money. That's where it comes back to the grudge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what was the grudge? And of course, we don't know what the grudge was. And my little timer just went off, and that means that we are out of time, and for this episode.
Yes,
so
we are.
I think we are going to need to continue this discussion because we still haven't even touched theories yet. And
We haven't.
Theorized a little bit, of course, already, but there is more stuff to talk about. And so what we're going to do is we're going to say sayonara for today and drop the second part in several days here so you can hear our deep, deep thoughts on who Cooper was and why he did it.
We're gonna give you our opinions on who Cooper was and what happened. And then sometime after that, we interviewed a bunch of experts at CooperCon in Vancouver, and we're going to show you what they had to say.
And of course, those guys are really happy to talk about this.
Yep. All right. So don't forget to give us a rating, a review, tell a friend about us.
And
don't forget to hit us up on social media, write us an email. Tess has got all that information for you coming up here in just a second. So we'll catch up with you as soon as possible where we give our theories on D.B. Cooper.
We will be talking to you again in a few days here with our theories about D.B. Cooper. Till then, you guys have a good Thanksgiving.
All right. Happy Thanksgiving.
The shocking details can be found at www.theshockingdetails.com. We're on Twitter at Shocking Details. For discussion of episodes and more, our Facebook group is facebook.com/groups/shockingdetailspodcast/. Or you can email us at theshockingdetailspodcast@gmail.com. And if you like the podcast, please consider giving us a like and a positive review and letting people know about us.
There's a man who lives a life of danger. To everyone he meets, he stays a stranger. I'm channeling my inner country western singer here. That's my best imitation yet of Taylor Swift.
Yeah. You sound just like her.
I sound like her from her early crossover days, not from her more recent pop stuff. But
if we auto-tune you, you might still sound like her.
Yeah, I don't actually want to sound like her, to be honest.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.